Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we multiplied, we needed more. The rich got rich, the poor got sore. The fuel ran scarce, the price jumped high, and so they gave nuclear power a try. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
But the nuclear plants built in haste, with too many risks and no place for waste. And so from Seabrook to Shoreham Town, we have to shut those new plants down. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Now we're fighting wars over oil and gas. No matter who wins, it will not last. The earth is scarred, the planet is warming. Don't you think that all of it's a great big warning?
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, 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 Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Pete Seeger with Dar Williams and David Burns, B-E-R-N-Z, who wrote the lyrics. Pete, we miss you, and we're just heartbroken. So we're back again. This is Harvey Wasserman, recovering here, another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We're going to be talking about nukes today, Fukushima, nukes in Michigan, waste policy. We had two women who met with the chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and also the great Kevin Camps. Kevin, and you're with us now?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, very good. And Gretel, you can hear me from Alabama, yes?
Yes, I can.
All right, very, very good. And we'll be joined by Susan Shapiro, who's in upstate New York, Pete Seeger, country in the Hudson Valley. We're going to have a good show today and talk about nukes. I just find it hard to believe that Pete Seeger is gone from us after 94 years, 70 in the public eye at least, and that was his song. I wrote about meeting with Pete. You can see it at a number of websites, EcoWatch, freepress.org, my own site that I edit, nukefree.org. It's my blog there. And just about how this song was, what song about the Solartopia song. But Pete, thanks so much for making this possible. Okay, we're going to jump in now. I want to start talking about Fukushima. Kevin Camps is one of the great stalwarts of the national anti-nuclear movement. Gretel Johnson, you're with us from Johnston, I guess, from Alabama. You're going to talk about your meetings with the NRC. But let's start with Kevin. Kevin, you're with the Beyond Nuclear organization. How long have you been involved with this issue, Kevin? It's been a while. You're getting to be a veteran already, even though you're a whippersnapper compared to me. But when did you get first involved with nuclear?
Well, it was actually a talk you gave at Western Michigan University in, let's see, it would have been spring of 1993 that I came out to hear you. And I had been involved in nuclear weapons issues before that for about a year or so, but hadn't been involved in nuclear power. So after being inspired by your talk, Harvey, I got involved locally in Michigan there, and it was right when the high-level waste was being plunked out on the beach of Lake Michigan, 100 yards from the water. So it was a real time to start because the state of Michigan Attorney General was suing the nuclear utility and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in federal court. So it was a real good time to jump into that fight.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that in a minute, but let's start with Fukushima now. Kevin, you are a Michigan native, a Kalamazoo boy, as it turns out, but I had a piece up, just went recently, 50 Reasons Why We Should Fear the Worst at Fukushima. I know you've been following it beyond nuclear. What are you thinking these days? I want to tell you, actually, I'm going to break a little news here. Although it's fairly well public knowledge, but tomorrow or the day after, I believe, the veterans of the USS Reagan, Ronald Reagan, the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, will be refiling their lawsuit in federal court. They were told by the judge that they had to file by the 6th of January, but so many new people have jumped in the lawsuit from the Reagan who were harmed by radiation from Fukushima that they were given another month. I believe the deadline is up on Thursday, and I believe I'm trying to arrange to have the attorney, one of the attorneys, and at least one of the atomic vets from the Reagan on the show a week from today. Kevin, you've been following Fukushima. What do you hear, and what's important to you about Fukushima at this point in time?
Well, that lawsuit you mentioned is a big one. I've had the opportunity to listen to one of the sailors last March for the second anniversary, so we're coming up on the third already. But there was a big gathering in New York City organized by Helen Caldicott last March 11th. And one of the sailors, a woman named Jamie Plim, spoke at a press conference, and they had already, you know, initiated this lawsuit. And she was the first one I ever heard say that the USS Ronald Reagan had been anchored just a mile or two offshore from Fukushima Daiichi. And when she said that, I just about fell out of my chair because I had always assumed it was further out to sea, and once they realized how bad the radioactive clouds were, they really headed out to sea by hundreds of miles. And then I heard a second sailor, another woman, a deckhand, and Jamie Plim was one of the crew in charge of steering and orienting the aircraft carrier, so she must have known what she was talking about in terms of distances and location. And then a second sailor, I heard, this was in an interview on television, she again repeated that they were a mile or two offshore from Fukushima Daiichi. And I don't claim to be on top of all the facts about the USS Ronald Reagan, but if they were that close to Fukushima Daiichi, that would have been like being in the maws of a blast furnace in terms of the radioactivity being emitted. And it really begs the question, why would they be that close? And one of the speculations I've had is that maybe in the initial days of they thought that somehow the Reagan could supply electricity to run. This is all speculation on my part. Perhaps the Reagan could supply electricity to the cooling and safety systems that were devastated by the natural disaster. But, of course, they would have run into the same problems had that been the plan that the mobile land-based power generators met. They had power generators moved in there by land in the first day trying to restore power. But when they tried to connect to the systems at Fukushima Daiichi, they found them to be under salt water because they were located in sub-basements. So they were destroyed. There was nothing to connect to. So
all right, let's. I don't want to let this one moment go by here. Let's talk about the sheer idiocy of, you know, I was in Japan in the mid-70s. You've been in Japan too, right, Kevin?
I was there in 2000. I went back in 2010, just 7 months before the catastrophe, and my first stop was Fukushima Daiichi. So I was there 7 months before this thing happened.
So you and I both go in the dark. I was there in the mid-70s. I marched with people, Japanese citizens, who were saying, hey, maybe you shouldn't really build nuclear power plants and near the in an earthquake zone washed by tidal waves. And, you know, so it's not like they weren't warned about this. And to top it off, these are General Electric reactors, and they had an 80-foot natural wall there against tsunamis, which they tore down for reasons of building the plant. And then they stuck the emergency backups and the key electrical connections in the basements. So, you know, they're saying the owners of Fukushima and the backers of nuclear plants are saying, well, this was an event that couldn't be predicted, and that therefore, you know, don't blame the nuclear industry. It's an act of God. I mean, how stupid could they have been?
Well, another event that you spoke at, Harvey, it would have been, September of 2011, and there were survivors of Fukushima who were present in New York City. It was a film showing of Gary Knowles knocking on the devil's door, and there was a panel discussion, and Eileen Miyoko Smith of Green Action Japan was on the panel as well, and she told the story, which, again, when I hear these things, it just knocks me out of my chair. She said that the Japanese nuclear power industry had greatly influenced decision-making on tsunami preparedness in Japan in the wrong direction. And I was like, wow, that's incredible. And then, sure enough, the Japanese parliament put out its report on the root causes of the nuclear catastrophe, and there was a whole section about how the Japanese nuclear industry had dominated tsunami preparedness decision-making. In order to save money, they lowered the heights of the required seawalls. And so that, in addition to what you said, Harvey, contributed to the disaster, and Eileen even made the point that by lowering seawalls, you know, it justified other places lowering seawalls, not just at the nuke plants, and people drown because of those decisions.
It's unbelievable. We're joined by Susan Shapiro. You're on with us from upstate New York.
Sorry.
Hi, Susan. How are you? And I hear your dog is with us.
Yes, sorry.
What's your dog's name?
Nui.
Nui, and she's anti-nuclear, I assume.
Oh,
so
of
we'll
course. Yes.
Take her point of view. So we're talking with Kevin Campster from Beyond Nuclear. We'll be joined in a couple minutes with Susan Shapiro from IPSEC, working against to shut the Indian Point reactor, and Gretel Johnston in Alabama. Susan and Gretel both met with the chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and with other members of the NRC. Kevin, have you ever met with the chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission?
Yeah, I've known Allison McFarland for quite a number of years now, and we have met since she's become the chair of the NRC a couple of times, yeah.
So you knew the chair, Allison McFarland, before she became the chair of the commission.
Yeah. I mean, you know, she was a part of that group of people that put out that report in January of 2003 that warned about the dangers of pool fires at nuclear power plants. So she's been involved in these issues for a long time, and kind of wondering where she went, because, you know, right now the NRC official position under her chairmanship is that there really is nothing to worry about with pool fires. So it's kind of hard to understand how she can be the chair and such statements can come out of the agency like that.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing the verbiage here. A pool fire, how does a pool catch on fire? Well, of course, at Fukushima, we have a spent fuel pool full of radioactive waste, which is 100 feet in the air at Unit 4. And they were taking the fuel out of this pool. Apparently, there was a pool fire at Fukushima 4 in the middle of the accident. And there's a letter to the IAEA, which the International Atomic Energy Agency, which the owners of Fukushima are now denying, saying that the fuel in the pool at Unit 4 did catch fire. Are you aware of that, Kevin?
Yeah, they started to backpedal on the whole fire fact in like mid-May of 2011, so just a couple months into this thing, you know, the initial official story was that there had been a fire, that the pool had drained of its cooling water or it had boiled away, and that's why they had sent the helicopters to drop water. That was trying to get the water back in the pool. So even by, you know, the end of May of 2011, for sure, they were saying, well, there may not have been a fire. We were wrong about that. So there's been a lot of backpedaling. I heard a DOE official say, this would have been May 26th of 2011 at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards meeting about Fukushima, that perhaps a section of the pool could have caught on fire because there are different sections of the pool. So I think the jury's still out on all the facts, but officially they now deny that there was ever a fire. But, you know, that risk of a fire remains with us now. That's why they're taking the fuel out of the pool ever so slowly, because it itself is a dangerous operation. Incredibly enough, they started doing that removal, I think it was November 18th of 2013. They finally started after so long a time of rebuilding the infrastructure to support the crane to lift 90-ton loads. They actually took the New Year's holiday off for 2 weeks, incredibly enough. I mean, here we are on the brink of global catastrophe, and they are treating it like it's routine business. So they took 2 weeks off from the fuel removal, and presumably they're underway again. It's going to take till the end of this year to get all the fuel out of that pool.
Oh, I'm going to guarantee you they won't be done by the end of this year. The question, of course, is in the pool with the spent fuel, if part of it caught fire, was it at the deep end with the diving board or down where the children are waiting in the shallow end? We're talking with Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear, Susan Shapiro, and Gretel Johnson will be joining us in a minute. I do want to get through Fukushima. We don't really know now. I mean, the State Secrets Act that the Japanese government has put in place to deprive the world of knowledge of this situation, I assume, is in place now. And I haven't seen a single article anywhere, maybe Susan or Gretel, you have, about the removal of the fuel from Unit 4 of Fukushima. Have you seen any coverage at all, any of the three of you?
No.
I haven't seen anything. Kevin, you follow
this
every day.
Yeah, the only coverage
I've seen any reports about removing fuel?
Yeah, the Asahi Shimbun is where I usually pick up my news about Fukushima. It's a major Japanese daily, and they're pretty radical, in a sense, in regards to Tokyo Electric's corruption, for one thing. They've had a few articles. They covered the beginning of the fuel removal. They covered the two-week vacation period at New Year's. And then Tokyo Electric also puts out press releases, and so they put out a animated video at the end of the year showing what was going on, and They ended it by saying it was a plan that was blessed by Lake Barrett of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which really caused me some fear because we've tangled with him for a long time. He was the director of the Yucca Mountain Project at DOE. So there's scant coverage. That much is true. And they leave you to assume that it's all going fine. But the State Secrets Act in Japan that was put in at the end of last year must strike some fear into the hearts of reporters. It was difficult enough to cover Fukushima before that law, and now not only reporters but also anti-nuclear activists have to worry about whether something they reveal might fall under the State Secrets Act and get them in tremendous trouble.
Well, I saw nothing in January, and now it's February already. I have seen zero reporting anywhere on what's probably the most dangerous and life-threatening engineering event in the world today, which is the attempted removal of these fuel rods from Fukushima Unit 4. And I'm assuming that this is because the State Secrets Act has essentially shut off any independent coverage. The last thing I saw, what you mentioned, Kevin, they put out a video allegedly showing what the removal of these fuel rods would be like. And we have to understand that these fuel rods in Unit 4 contain as much as 14,000 times the cesium that was released at Hiroshima. This is a potentially apocalyptic event. And there's been, since the State Secrets Act, I've seen zero coverage of this highly dangerous stuff. And the cartoon that Tokyo Electric Power put out about this portrays an undamaged fuel pool, which we know is most definitely not the case at Unit 4, of beautifully intact vehicles carrying beautifully intact fuel rods. None of these fuel rods are undamaged, as best we can tell, you know, in a perfectly controlled situation. I mean, it probably has that cartoon probably has as much to do with reality at Fukushima 4 as the Disney version of Pocahontas has to do with what really happened in early America there.
Yeah, you've probably
so
got the salt water that was used for cooling, which has corroded the fuel. You've got, you know, the explosion, which may have damaged things, the earthquake itself. So you've got debris in the pool, and if anything is stuck, you know, then they're going to yank on it, and they could easily fracture the fuel, you know. So that, like you said, the end of the year being complete with this project assumes that everything goes well.
Oh, you know, and
the big assumption.
These fuel rods have to be not bent. They have to be not swollen. They have to be able to be removed. I would say that the odds on them doing this within the next 10 years are next to zero. But the problem is now we're not hearing anything about it. Now, Susan, you're in upstate New York, and there are two reactors near you. I've slept on your couch, so I know. And another one, another reactor that's been dead since the 90s, I believe, because it lacked an emergency core cooling system. Now, you have fuel rods in pools on the Hudson River, and you also have an earthquake fault, the Ramapo fault, that has elevated Indian Point to the top of the NRC's danger list. Are you following Fukushima, and what was your impression of your meeting with the chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission?
Well, yeah, we are definitely following Fukushima because we have two fault lines here, actually. We're two intersecting fault lines. We have the Ramapo fault and the Stanford fault that runs right under Indian Point. And we have 2,700 tons of waste. So everyone's following it very closely.
What did the chair, Allison McFarland, of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, have to say about that situation when you met with her? What was it, last week?
Yeah. She. I do believe that, as Kevin said, you know, prior to her being the chairwoman, she was clearly concerned about the spent fuel pools, and I believe she still is. Her problem being, she's a single voice on a committee, and she's outvoted repetitively, constantly, all the time. She took over from JASCO, who was kicked out basically by the other parties on the committee. So her voice, though she's the chairwoman, is not any louder than the other four members. So she's just one of five.
Let's talk about that for a minute. Her predecessor was Gregory Jasko, whose name I can never spell. Mm-hmm. I've written his name in dozens of articles, and every time I get it wrong. I think it's J-A-C-Z-K-O. Is that correct?
Jasko. Yeah, Jasko.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So Gregory Jasko was former staffer for Harry Reid and Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader, and became the chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and was actually critical of the nuclear industry, which the industry cannot tolerate, and they forced him out on bullying charges, which is insane. I guess they expected him to next become the governor of New Jersey, and now he's gone, but Heather McFarland, Allison McFarland, is in there, and she seems to be outvoted 4-1 every time. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's what I gathered. And she does seem to understand the issues, but there's not much she can do. And she, it seems like, you know, she's sort of silenced at that end. We went there really specifically to talk about two issues, which was the high burn-up fuel issue and how that impacts actually the spent fuel pools and any kind of long-term storage or temporary storage, which they really didn't consider, and the issue of the lack of radiation monitoring, both by the NRC and the EPA. And what we found out was a little more frightening than we expected, actually.
Wow. Well, tell us about that. Gretel Johnston, you were in these meetings as well. Were you as frightened as Susan Shapiro?
Yes. But I'm constantly frightened. I live downwind of Browns Ferry.
Oh, yeah. You have the distinction of living downwind from the only nuclear power It's hard to say these things sometimes. You live downwind from the only nuclear power plant that was set on fire by a workman using a candle.
That's right. You can't hold a candle to nuclear power.
That's true. Okay. So, Kevin, you and Susan and Gretel, you've all been involved with the issue of nuclear waste in the United States. The commission has been holding these dog and pony shows, otherwise known as hearings, to talk about the disposal of nuclear waste in the United States. We have a few minutes before we're going to take a break. Kevin, do you want to comment on that, and then Susan can jump in. What is happening with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and their attempt to come up with some kind of policy on nuclear waste now?
Well, they have their Orwellian policy called Nuclear Waste Confidence, which was a blank check to the industry to make as much waste as they wanted to. They had never done an environmental impact statement under the National Environmental Policy Act. But that all changed in 2012 when a coalition of environmental groups and also a coalition of states, including the state of New York, the Attorney General, filed a lawsuit against the NRC on this matter and beat them in federal court at the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. So this whole, you mentioned the hearings across the country, about a dozen or more, and a, you know, several-month-long comment period to comment on the draft generic environmental impact statement that NRC was ordered by the courts to undertake. And our side did really, really well. I heard great things about the Indian Point area hearing. I read a lot of the testimony that the public presented, including Susan's. And, man, I think our side did really well, and I think we're in a really good position to sue the NRC again because they've shown that they're just not going to carry out, you know, upgrades to safety that are required.
Susan, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, along with that, one of the major things that they totally omitted is, and which was only found out really through decommissioning at San Onofre, was that right now all nuclear reactors are producing high burn-up fuel, which is a much hotter and more radioactive waste, and it's not even considered anywhere. I mean, I shouldn't say not. They mention it once or twice, but they don't actually do any kind of evaluation or consideration about the impacts of it. And it turns out, having gone down and met with engineers at the NRC and the different commissioners, is they actually don't even know how it reacts or how it what to do with it. And they just started, the DOE just started doing a 10-year test on the results of how to store high burn-up fuel. And basically the NRC says, you know what, it's not our problem, it's the DOE's problem. Let's kick the can down the road, and that's going to turn out to be the public's problem. Because they basically approved a use of a fuel that's much more dangerous, and they don't even know what to do with it. Not that they know what to do with the other stuff, but this is worse.
All right, so high burn-up fuel. How is high burn-up fuel different from regular fuel? And then we're going to take a quick break here and return to this after the break.
Well, pretty simply is what happened is it was an economic reason that they allowed it, is the reactors want to keep the fuel in the reactor longer so that they can make more money. So they'll keep it in longer, and it becomes more highly radioactive. So anything over 45, I forget what the term is, but Gretel probably remembers.
Megawatts per day.
What's that, Gretel?
I think it's megawatts per day.
Right.
45 megawatts per day.
Correct. Then it becomes high burn-up fuel, and then it, instead of being required to stay in the spent fuel pools for 5 years to cool down enough to put in dry cask storage, they have to stay anywhere from 7 to 10 years or possibly more in the spent fuel pools.
Let's break here while we're in the middle of this technical discussion. We're going to talk about high burn-up fuel when we're going to come back, and I also want to talk about the fact that they used MOX fuel, mixed oxide fuel, from nuclear bombs in Fukushima Unit 3, and it appears that it may well have had a fission explosion and turned out to be a bomb after all. We're talking with Kevin Camp, Susan Shapiro, and Gretel Johnston about nuclear power, Fukushima, Indian Point near New York. My whole crew, I'm sure, in New York is all ears about Indian Point, which is only 25, 30 miles away from our studio in New York. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in 3 minutes or so and resume this conversation.
Coal plant
plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan.
Okay, they haven't ended the break yet.
Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Solar Tokyo is home sweet home to me.
Yes, indeed. Lots of forest for the bears. That's a great Dana Lyons singing the Solartopia Rocky Top version. Dana is the author and singer of The Wonderful Cows with Guns. Go see it online. I think there are over 2 million views now for this wonderful anthem of the vegetarian movement. We're talking with Kevin Camps of Beyond Nuclear, Susan Shapiro of IPSEC, upstate New York, Finding Indian Point, and Gretel Johnston down in Alabama. Gretel, you were in on the meetings with the chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Allison McFarland. You also met with some other people. I think you met with Mr. Magwood and another commissioner. What was your impression of the commissioners of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission? Tell us what you thought of their attentiveness.
Well, I was impressed with the knowledge base of McFarland and Apostolakis, who is a professor at MIT, and he was quite keen and his questions were really significant, I thought. We had a long talk with Magwood as well. Magwood seemed to be kind of shifting the responsibility over to the DOE and the EPA as much as possible. But that was one of the things that came out of our meeting. We realized we needed to get these agencies to build bridges for responsibility to the public.
Susan Shapiro, how about you? What did you think of meeting with the commissioners? You met with the chair and then two commissioners, right?
Right. I agree with what Gretel said, is I thought that Magwood was the most remote, and he was very, you know, they were all very professional, but I don't know whether he really heard what we were saying. I mean, one of the issues that came up was that he had voted on an action regarding the waste storage, and he claimed that it included high burn-up fuel, but when we pointed out it didn't, he was like, oh, I better go take a look at that. And he just voted on it last week, so I wonder how careful they actually review what they're looking at. One of the main issues, as Gretel was saying, that we were raising is who's monitoring the store? Who's monitoring the releases, the radioactive releases, which was like a big question that we had also about Fukushima, because we had understood that the EPA had monitors and they weren't turned on. And so we also met with the EPA, about that. But the NRC, it was interesting. Magwood said, oh yeah, that would be great if we had monitoring and we can all know about it, because we thought that the NRC actually was doing real-time monitoring on site, but they're actually not. They're leaving it to the reactor owners to do it whatever way they choose to, and then do quarterly estimates, which, as far as we can tell, is an antiquated system. And it's insane that in this day and age, with all of the technology available, that's what's still being, approved. And then, of course, the NRC says, well, we can't monitor off-site, and the EPA says, well, we don't monitor on-site. So each one is passing the buck to the other. And one of our... Yeah, that's where we stand today.
Shocking. Kevin Camps, you do this full time. What's your impression of the NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, working with the Environmental Protection Agency? What are they telling us about radiation coming into the public purview from nuclear power plants?
As little as they can get away with. I mean, the NRC, which I work with mostly, is a completely captured agency by the industry it's supposed to regulate. I mean, Commissioner Magwood, talk about the revolving door. He came from industry to begin with, did a lot of work for Westinghouse, also worked for Tokyo Electric in his private capitalist days, and then went to work at the Department of Energy for many years under both Republican and Democratic administrations, and was in charge of promotions at DOE. It's called the Office of Nuclear Energy, which is promotional for nuclear power. And then got this plum job over at the commission. So, you know, these revolving doors between industry and promotions and supposed regulation are very corrupting and corrupt. And, you know, an issue that came to mind as I was listening to the others talk was during the Nuclear Waste Confidence public hearings, for the first time in the draft environmental impact statement, the full list of known pool leaks in the country was published. And the reason I was invited to Japan and went to Fukushima Daiichi in the first place was the public there, the anti-nuclear movement, concerned citizens, wanted to hear more about these pool leaks in the United States. And we knew about five of them at the time in the summer of 2010. But in this NRC Nuclear Waste Confidence EIS, they listed more than a dozen. And one of the most infamous of all is Indian Point, with pool leakage going right into the Hudson River. So the NRC just seems way too comfortable with all this stuff going on, with tritium leaks into groundwater, with pools leaking into surface waters. The list just goes on and on of things that they're just fine with. They think it's just fine. There's no problem.
And our big push is to make radiation visible, because the part of the problem is, unlike any other kind of toxin, this is being released and nobody knows. And like Kevin said, it's in the groundwater, it's in drinking water, it actually has health impacts. And so what we went down was really to talk about making radiation visible, and Gretel really put together a wonderful presentation on that. And we're left with that. We're preparing a white paper on the issue. And one thing I'd like to ask is any of your listeners who know about independent radiation monitoring going on right now to let us know about it. It would be helpful.
Okay, you can write me at listeners, write me at nukefree.org. And Susan, what is your website or how to get in touch with you, Susan Shapiro?
You can go to susan.hito@gmail.com, H-I-T-O. It's susan.hito. @gmail.com.
Right, and I want to just mention that your husband is from Easter Island, which is the only person I've ever met from Easter Island. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go on a rant here. I'm going to tell you that first of all, Kevin, just on a personal basis, I hope you never ever go back to Fukushima, let alone Japan. You're a young guy, you haven't had your kids yet, and don't go there. I mean,
I had the fortune of being there before the catastrophe began, 7 months
right,
earlier.
Right, well, don't go back. And I will never, I tell everybody I know, this place is radioactive, and Fukushima is a death hole, and people should not be going to Japan, and let alone eating sushi or anything now from Japan. I hate to say that, I love Japan, I love being there. I was from September of 75 to January of 76, and I went back in the summer of 78, and, you know, it's a tragedy, but it's a dead zone, and I would be very, very wary of anyone going to Japan. If you know people, I would get them out, and it's only going to get worse. Now, I want to take something here that's very important, all three of you, having met with the NRC and Kevin doing this full time, Susan, I know you're on the case all the time, and Gretel, what we've stated here is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, you guys have met with the commissioners and with the EPA, is kicking around the idea, kicking around the reality of monitoring radiation. Now, this is 70 years since Hiroshima, almost, for God's sakes, 1945 to 2014. So we're on the brink of the seventh decade. And here we are. We've had nuclear reactors operating in this country since 1959 at Shippingport, Pennsylvania. We still do not have, after all these years, a national radiation monitoring system. We do not know how much radiation is coming down on us and how much is coming out of the 100 commercial reactors left operating in the United States, let alone the 400 plus operating around the world. And yet we have people from this industry running around saying that there's no dose of radiation coming from nuclear power plants that can harm anybody. It's a staggering situation here. I have sat and listened to people say that no one will be harmed from Fukushima, that the radiation is not enough to harm anybody, when nobody has any idea how much radiation is coming from Fukushima, let alone from any of the nuclear power plants in the United States of America. Correct me if I'm wrong. Do we have, well, I'm just going to state it. The fact of the matter is we do not know how much radiation is coming from any or all of the commercial reactors in the United States, and yet we have an industry that's telling us that we have no worries about radiation coming from the reactors in the United States. Is that a fair assessment of the situation? Let's start with you, Gretel. Do you know how much radiation is coming from Browns Ferry, which you live near?
Okay, I will tell you, we have records that are given to us by the industry itself, by the operators of the nuclear power plant. They report quarterly averages of the of some of the radionuclides. Quarterly, they only report annually these quarterly averages. That's what we think is terribly inadequate given our current state of technology. The other,
Fox is telling you.
We have what they say. We also have started our own program of monitoring, and we did a report that was published last summer on the Browns Ferry radiation and radioactive emissions and the health hazards in the area surrounding Browns Ferry. And we have found downwind from 2 to 50 times background radiation levels. So and Susan has found that they are emitting 50% more at Indian Point than they are allowed to. But no one is watching, no one is enforcing the limit. And as we said earlier, the EPA is putting it on the NRC, the NRC is putting it on the DOE and the EPA. And so what we're going to try and do this year is to make sure that they connect the dots and that there are compatible technologies to monitor all the different agencies. The states are doing more monitoring. The states have to pay for them. At least they do here in Alabama. They have to pay for it themselves. But no one is connecting the dots.
All right, so let's get some perspective on here. Susan Shapiro and Gretel Johnston, you have just met with three commissioners of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. You have met with people at the Environmental Protection Agency. Both of these two agencies are responsible for telling us how much radiation is coming out of these nuclear plants. One is kicking the ball to the other and back. And Susan Shapiro, you who live so close to Indian Point, tell us, how reliable is the information coming out of Indian Point about how much nuclear fallout is coming from these reactors?
Well, it's sort of laughable because actually what we learned from the NRC is they said, well, it's proprietary to the owners of the plant, so we can't actually, you know that because it's the owners of the plant, and we don't have those documents, so you can't see them. So the only way that we know that 50% more was released is during the relicensing hearings. We have a leak contention because, like as you mentioned, our spent fuel pool is leaking. And so we actually got data that shows over the past years, it's not current, but that they've released 50% more than their license allows. Because, you know, most of these plants are licensed to release 60 pounds of radioactive whatever into the atmosphere each day. Effluent or, you know.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
And so they were releasing 90 pounds, which is 50% more, roughly, on an average. But the other thing is the EPA now is coming. They just put out, just moments ago, they put out a 120-day comment period on they want to change the radiation standards. And we believe they want to change them to make them less restrictive, which they're already horrible to begin with, and they don't consider fetuses and infants and children. So I'll send you that, Harvey, and if you could share that with everybody, that would be wonderful.
I will post it at nukefree.org. Anybody listening and wants to see this, go to nukefree.org. Kevin, you are now a 20-year veteran of full-time anti-nuclear work. Tell us what you think of the reliability of the information that we get about how much radiation is escaping from nuclear power plants in the United States.
Well, I mean, it's woefully inadequate on a good day, and there's a lot of cover-up going on. So, for example, at Braidwood, Illinois, which was a very significant event, didn't get much national coverage at all, but it got some coverage in Illinois. A mom whose daughter was struck with childhood brain cancer started asking some questions, and it turned out that there were five of these rare childhood brain cancers in a single elementary school in Morris, Illinois, which is the hometown of the Dresden nuclear power plant, which are three General Electric Mark I boiling water reactors, plus a high-level radioactive waste storage facility. Well, her asking questions is what finally, after many years, led to the revelation, not at Dresden, where she lived, but just up the road 20 miles at Braidwood Nuclear Power Plant, two reactors, that they had massive releases of radioactive hydrogen called tritium into groundwater. We're talking millions of gallons of radioactive water released into the groundwater. Sometimes it would flood ditches on the side of the road in the neighborhood. So long story short, they had to buy up a number of area homes from the homeowners just to make it Exelon property so that they could now say, well, it's not past the fence line. That's because they moved the fence line. And that was covered up for a decade, and it took a single person, eventually through Freedom of Information Act, she got this information out. So, you know, they're lying to us, blatantly, and when they get caught, then they spin out of it, you know. Right now they have this voluntary initiative. The NRC, a French colleague asked me, so what are the levels of radioactive contamination in groundwater in the United States? And he was floored when I told him they're not required to report it. It's a voluntary initiative. If the utilities want to tell us how bad the groundwater contamination is, then they can, or if they choose not to, they don't have to.
All right, so I'm going to make a statement here. We're getting, unfortunately, near the end of the show, and I have three great people with me, Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear and Susan Shapiro from IPSEC in upstate New York and Gretel Johnston from near Browns Ferry in Alabama. I'm going to make a statement here that everybody should understand, including our crew in New York, which is only 25 to 35 miles from Indian Point, which is that when these people come out and they say that radiation from nuclear power plants is not sufficient to harm anyone, and that there has been no one even threatened by nuclear plants, which we're hearing all the time now from the nuclear industry, that especially in the wake of Fukushima, they've really, you know, turned to be very offensive here and saying that we don't have to worry about a radiation from nuclear power plants, even from Fukushima. I'm going to tell you very clearly, based on certainly on what these three guests and many others have said, they have no idea. We have no idea. As citizens of the United States, we have absolutely no idea how much radiation is escaping from nuclear power plants in this country or around the world, where it's going, or who it's impacting. And when the industry turns around and says, for example, that no one was harmed at Three Mile Island, and in fact there was a federal court case that was thrown out, a class action suit, the judge says that not enough radiation escaped from Three Mile Island in 1979 to harm anyone, she had absolutely no idea. The industry has absolutely no idea about how much radiation escaped at Three Mile Island or at Chernobyl or even at Fukushima or, more importantly, actually, on a day-to-day basis from the nuclear power plants that are operating every day in this country, including the ones in Indian Point, just 35 miles north of New York City. I want to add, by the way, interestingly enough, Lake Barrett, who was part of the nuclear industry, actually testified in front of Congress after Three Mile Island. He was with the NRC, and he admitted that they didn't know how much radiation came out at Three Mile Island. And yet we have people going on CNN and all this other major media saying, don't worry, all these people are fanatics. They're not to be taken seriously. The radiation from nuclear plants is the equivalent of eating a banana, which is utterly insane, and will not harm you when, in fact, they have absolutely no idea how much radiation is coming out, even after 7 decades after the bombings at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It's staggering. Absolutely infuriating to me, and I'm sure it is to
Harvey,
you guys, and you know, where will the end come?
Harvey, the reason is, just as, from a legal perspective, I believe the reason that they're not monitoring is because this way we can't prove damage. we can only prove that people are getting sick, but we don't know how, because of how much. And so by preventing any kind of meaningful monitoring, that's what is actually occurring. They've actually stopped us from being able to bring a tort action. As a lawyer, that's what I believe is going on. And I just want to tell you a quick story that I think is people will really understand. Is the reason I got involved in this whole monitoring issue is I got a call from my town supervisor after there was a transformer explosion in Indian Point. And he calls me on my cell phone and asked me if there's a release. And I said, why don't you call emergency services? And he says, oh, because I can't depend on them. They rely on Entergy, the owner of Indian Point, to tell them if there's been a release. And that's happening all over the country.
Absolutely. So listen, we're down to 5 minutes. Very quickly, Gretel Johnston, what's your website? How do people get a hold of you if you want?
Yes, it's matter, MATRR.org. That stands
okay.
for Mothers Against Tennessee River Radiation.
And that's Gretel Johnston, downwind from Browns Ferry in Alabama. Susan Shapiro, your website and how to get a hold of you?
IPSECinfo.org is the best way, or clearwater.org or riverkeeper.org. They all have a lot of great information.
All right, very good. And Kevin Camps at Beyond Nuclear?
Yeah, our website is just beyondnuclear.org. And if folks want to email me, it's kevin@beyondnuclear.org.
Okay, so what the situation we have now here is, thank you very much, the situation we have now, we have 2 minutes, is that we have an untested radiation emitter, 100 of them in the United States operating. We have no idea how much radiation is escaping and where it's going. And so I want you very quickly, all three of you, as your swan song here, give us about 15 or 20 seconds each about what you think about the idea that no one is being harmed by nuclear power. Gretel, you're right down river from Browns Ferry. Give us a quick one here.
Well, I just think that is not supported by science. And we need to stick with science on this. There's no safe dose of radiation. There is no dose that's low enough.
Okay. Susan Shapiro?
Well, we did a simple study based on cancer registry in New York around Indian Point and around the whole area, and we found out that thyroid cancer, which is a marker for exposure to radiation, is about 70% higher than the rest of the country. So I believe that there's definitely a correlation between radioactive releases and illness.
And Kevin Camps.
Yeah, well, Gretel hit it on the nose when she said that the National Academy of Sciences has affirmed for decades that any exposure to ionizing radioactivity carries a health risk for cancer, and those risks accumulate over a lifetime.
All right, and thank you very much, the three of you. Next week, we're going to talk with Charles Bonner and at least one of the sailors exposed on the USS Ronald Reagan aircraft carrier downwind from Fukushima. Thank you, the three of you, and let's shut all these nuclear plants down. This has been Harvey Wasserman. Thanks to the crew in New York, and we'll see you next week again in Solartopia. Keep the faith and no nukes.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.
We bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green.
We needed more. The rich got rich, the poor got sold. The fuel ran scarce, the price jumped high, and so they gave nuclear power a try.